Hi, I'm Johanna Ferreira, Content Director of Pop Sugar Juntos. Juntos is all about celebrating Latinx culture, pride, our many intersectional identities, and joy. Thanks to support from Prime, there's so much to get into over at Juntos this month. From conversations with the Latinx minds behind our favorite new movies and resurrected TV shows, to thoughtful celebrity commentary and exclusive interviews with some of the biggest Latin music artists today. And it doesn't stop there. Get more of the music, movies, and shopping you love on Prime. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more of whatever you're into from streaming to shopping. And get all of our latest coverage at popsugar.com/juntos. Con amor, Johanna.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
The thing I still wonder about was when Trump went in on Friday in Pensacola. Man, thank you for not going in Sunday. Because Friday night, Moore went ahead 4 points again. Saturday, it was 3 points. Sunday, it was 2 points. We're sitting there Monday night going like, keep drifting. But Monday night, we were up by two.
Hello, welcome to the Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I am excited about this episode. So I've got Joe Trippi on the show this week. And Joe is, I've known him for a long time. I knew him back on the Howard Dean campaign when he was a campaign manager. He was an early reader of my earliest blog. I had like 32 readers. And one of them turned out to be Joe Trippi, who invited me to intern for the campaign for a couple months, which I did. So I've known him a long time. He's not just a great political consultant, but one of the real early theorists and practitioners of how the internet would change media. He's worked for a lot of folks, Ted Kennedy, Walter Mondale, Gary Hart, Dick Gephardt, Jerry Brown, John Edwards. But pretty importantly right now, he was a chief media strategist on the Doug Jones campaign. So he was there from the beginning, from the early discussions with Doug Jones about whether he should run, through the entire campaign, the runoff between Luther Strange and Roy Moore, the eventual win, the construction of the ads, the reading of the polls, all of it. And this is a really fun discussion where he really does give the inside story of that campaign, including a lot of things that I didn't know or had assumed the opposite. Trippi talks in here about there are ways in which the sexual predation allegations against Roy Moore actually helped his campaign. Donald Trump was a lot more useful to the Moore campaign than I had thought he was in my understanding of how things had gone. The race was much, much, much more stable than the polling suggested. There's a lot in here that changed my understanding of this race. And so I think y'all are going to enjoy it quite a bit. Two quick things before we jump into it. One, of course, happy holidays. Thank you to all of you for listening. This is I believe this episode is coming out on Christmas Day. So I hope you enjoy it as you are escaping your family or enjoy it on the way back from seeing your family or whatever it might be. But thank you for being part of this podcast. Also, check out the Weeds Facebook group. I've been going in there to the Weeds, of course, is my other podcast with Matt Iglesias and Sarah Cliff and others, where we talk about policy and politics twice a week. I love that podcast. If you're not listening to it, you should be. But our Facebook group is really fantastic. It's got about 12,000 people almost in it now. It's just an amazing, rollicking discussion of policy and politics. And I use it every week to ask about questions for my interviewees. I've been amazed by how great the questions some of you all are offering me are. There are a bunch of your questions in this interview with Trippi. But if you're interested in that, go join the Weeds Facebook group. You can find it on the Facebook machine. And it's a good place not only to connect with other people who are into these podcasts, but also if you're interested to give me some feedback on how this is going, what questions you want to hear me ask of upcoming guests. As always, you can also email me at EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. All that said, here is Joe Trippi. Joe Trippi, welcome to the podcast.
Good to be with you.
We've known each other a long time.
A long time, yeah.
From the early days of blogging.
Yeah, absolutely. The first days.
Yeah, the first days. Yeah. And now I think it is a big jump for me to imagine the campaign manager of like the great liberal insurgency of 2004. And now you're helping win races in Alabama.
Yeah, that one I didn't see coming.
It's your personal 50 state like, strategy. Yeah.
It worked. I mean, I never would have thought back in the Dean days, yeah, that I'd be helping to win the first Democratic Senate seat in Alabama in a quarter of a century. It's pretty amazing.
How did you first hear of Doug Jones?
I had done work in Alabama in the past. I mean, going way back to the 80s and early 90s, and a guy by the name of Giles Perkins, who's a wonderful Democrat down there. I'd worked with him in the past, and he called me up and said there was a guy named Doug Jones he wanted me to meet. I went down, and Doug was kind of not on the fence about running. He was, are you crazy? Are you guys crazy? It's Alabama. No Democrats won in 25 years, and we've got to make the fight, but I don't want to do a suicide mission. I want to run. If I'm going to run,
so what is the nature of this meeting? Or is Giles Perkins trying to convince Doug Jones to run? Are you trying to like what
sort
meeting
of,
are we
yeah.
having, and when is it happening?
Whenever the seat opened up. I mean, I'm trying to. He was not ambivalent. He wanted to run. He thought somebody had to stand up and fight, but he didn't want to do a suicide mission kind of thing. And so Giles and I and another guy named Doug Turner sat down at dinner with him, with a couple of other friends of his, and we had this long conversation about why it was possible, and he decided, let's do it. And
at that moment, so this is before the Republican primary happens.
Oh yeah,
before there's Roy Moore. Yeah. What is your argument for why it is possible?
That I thought there was a real hunger to stop the division that was going on, that Trump was actually driving people to want to end the chaos. Even if you liked him, you didn't want more chaos in Washington than what he was already creating. And so that I thought if we could appeal to that in Alabama, that would get us close. Doug Turner and Giles agreed with that, but they also believed that they could get a significant turnout with, particularly in the African American community, because of Doug's prosecuting the Klan. I mean, that he had a real attachment to the community and so that if we could pull those two things together, get enough Republicans to believe we got to stop the division and find common ground, and at the same time not have that message dampen the enthusiasm that was naturally there for a guy like Doug Jones, maybe we could pull it off. And so, and even if we didn't, speaking out that way in Alabama, there'd be some building going on that could make Alabama move in the direction of, making another Democrat in the future more possible. And so talking around the table that way, it was kind of like Doug decided, hey, I'm going to go, I'm going to run to win, but I want to do it in a way that actually builds a bridge and makes it possible that if I lose, that we've made the road a little bit easier for the next guy that comes along or woman that comes along.
Tell me a bit about your first impressions of Doug Jones. I mean, now Doug Jones is like this sort of heroic name to liberals, the guy who took Alabama back and stopped Roy Moore. But when you just met him, like as a person, what were your impressions of him? What were your impressions of him over the campaign? Like what kind of guy is Doug Jones?
The two most decent people I've ever worked for would be like Walter Mondale and Doug Jones. I mean, they're totally different, eras and maybe on the spectrum ideologically. Jones isn't by any means a Mondale kind of liberal, but just amazing character and just a real decent person. I mean, we need more like him in Washington.
Give me an example.
He just wouldn't, he's just not a politician. I mean, that gets kind of like, oh, yeah, sure, he's not. But he just doesn't think that way. He really is a guy who prosecuted those, the Klansmen and went back. You got to think about it. That terror attack on that church happened like 38 years before anybody got justice. It was a cold case. He went and dug up and decided he was going to, get justice. And he did. And he's just a guy who wants to do what's right, do the right thing. And he's committed to, you know, equality for all and a lot of things that right now are in jeopardy, I think.
So you, when Doug Jones decides to run, he wins the Democratic primary pretty easily. Is there even another serious candidate in it?
Yeah, well, it wasn't as easy as everybody, you know.
Thinks
it's
so.
Like everything, yeah. Everything is like, no, there, we were running against Robert Kennedy Jr., a guy named Robert Kennedy Jr.
Is he a Kennedy?
No,
Kennedy?
No, but no one knew, you know. I mean, you know, you go to the ballot and there's a guy named Robert Kennedy Jr. or Doug Jones. And let me tell you, no one knew who Doug Jones was. I mean, in that primary.
It does. Doug Jones does sound like a name that you would pick to like hide your real name.
Yeah. But I'm just saying it was like, it was one of those things where we knew, we desperately knew we had to avoid a runoff. So we had to run enough of a campaign to make sure we got over 50. And we weren't really sure, again, because of the Robert Kennedy Jr. thing, how strongly we had to fight that out. But we I think, got 65% of the vote in the primary. So we avoided the runoff, which was key because that, and by the way, at that point, no one was paying attention, right? No one was even really paying attention to the Luther Strange, Roy Moore vote very much. I mean, they were, but in the lead up to that primary. So on primary day, it turns out it's Luther Strange and Roy Moore on their side, and they're in a runoff. And we avoid a runoff, which means we get to watch the two of them just tear each other apart for, till the 26th of September. That was actually a key thing. It had to happen. I mean, we had to have that, I think, that fight go on and have fragments of the Republican Party disenchanted with whoever the nominee is. We weren't sitting there, you know, rooting for Roy Moore. We thought if Luther Strange wins this runoff, the Roy Moore people are going to have problems with him. And if Roy Moore wins, the Luther Strange people are going to have problems with him. We need that. We need to be, because that's those would be the people we would try to reach with the common ground message that, look, let's, you know, we've tried this big fight thing. Let's try to come together now in unity.
That sounds unintuitive to me, that if Luther Strange had won the runoff, that you would have been going after Roy Moore voters with a common ground message.
Yeah, because you have to, three things had to happen for a bunch of Republicans had to stay home. A bunch of Republicans had to move to us, or a bunch of Republicans had to write in somebody. I mean, I'm talking now, we'll get to the thing with Roy Moore. Those, all three of those things have to happen. And at the same time, you have to have a massive turnout of African-Americans, millennials, and win over independents big and win women and have, you know, a lot of women turn out.
So I think a lot of the people listening to this, and this is probably true for me too, even though we sent people down to cover the race and we profiled Roy Moore pretty early on, a lot of us have mostly experienced Roy Moore through sort of Roy Moore headlines, right? The Roy Moore allegations in the Washington Post of sexual predation of teenagers, the kind of much more controversial things Roy Moore has said. But you obviously now were watching Roy Moore for a long time in a more day-to-day way. Tell me about Roy Moore. Like, how would you describe to somebody who's not in Alabama politics the role Roy Moore played and the way he portrayed himself and appealed to people?
Well, in a lot of ways, he's the perfect foil for our message, right? He's divisive. He thrives on chaos. He's, at every turn, a controversial figure. On everything. I mean, from being removed twice from the court for not removing the Ten Commandments. I mean, just things like that were always controversial and always kind of mean-spirited and I mean, you know, where he did take money from neo-Nazi groups. I mean, things like that. I mean, there was just nothing redeeming about the guy in terms of—
So is that true? I mean, so help me on this, because still 50% roughly of the vote went to Roy Moore, right?
Yeah.
48%, I guess. And he is a guy who, if some things hadn't come out, maybe it would have been 52%, right? It's possible. What did Alabamians see in him? I mean, because they didn't think there's nothing redeeming about him. Like, when you saw Roy Moore, was there ever a moment where you're like, I get how he appeals to people. I get what connection he is creating with that audience.
No, he connects with his audience the same, in a lot of ways, the same way Trump connects with his supporters. I mean, there's real support for him. I mean, it is, we knew every single Roy Moore voter, you know what, how many Roy Moore voters there are in the state, because every single one of them voted for him. I mean, not one of them stayed home. That didn't happen. That's not who stayed home. I think a lot of Luther Strange voters may have stayed home. And by the way, I think a lot of Roy Moore voters would have stayed home had it been Luther Strange. I mean, that's part of what was going on here. There is a big divide in the party. It extends to Alabama. And Roy Moore and Luther Strange sort of represented, you know, the two sides of that. But, you know, Roy Moore engenders like really strong, another one of those guys who could kill somebody on go shoot somebody in Times Square and or Fifth Avenue and you know, it'd be okay, you know. So
tell me where the election was in your polling, in your estimation, before the allegations.
Oh, we know. We know exactly. I mean, we had been running our really strong message on finding common ground and came out of the field the day before the Washington Post allegation story. And that day we were behind by one point, 46 to 45. I could point out that the day before this election, we were ahead in our own survey by 2 points, and we ended up winning by like 1.8 or something. So as far as we're concerned, all those other polls that were doing 11 points, 8 points, you know, and all over the place, we feel pretty solidly that we were, you know, we were always on top of the pulse of what was happening. And it was a dead heat before the day before the allegations came out. In a weird way, the key to us having a chance was to detribalize the politics of the state. If Alabama was reacting to the tribal politics of our times, there was no way for us to win, right? So the whole message of common ground, of reaching out, of talking to each other, of finding ways of, you know, where we actually, you know, Jones literally looked, spoke directly to the people in this ad, this honor ad we called Honor, where he said, you know, there's honor and compromise and civility. I mean, think about that in the era of Trump in Alabama, with our tribalized politics. So what had closed the entire race to a dead heat was we had effectively, Doug Jones had effectively removed that you know, people running to their two corners. And what was sort of astonishing really was the allegations created tribalism again, right? Suddenly we're back into, well, you know, Republicans who don't believe the charges, it's the media out to get Roy Moore. I mean, this he's able to start tribalizing the race. Trump is coming in now with him. And every time that happened, Roy Moore would open a lead.
I mean, so you're saying the allegations in some ways helped him in your poll?
In a weird way, yeah. Because a lot of the things that people didn't like about him, the fact that he'd been removed from office twice, the fact that it started a religious charity and taken $1 million from it after he told everybody he wasn't making any money from it. I mean, many things that kind of had bothered people about him, that things that had come out in that Luther Strange, Roy Moore primary, they were totally knocked off the charts by the allegations. And those other allegations, I mean, the other problems that people had with them were sort of across party lines. It wasn't, you know, if you take $1 million and lie about it or don't tell the truth about it, whatever word you want to use, there are plenty of Republicans who are like scratching their heads saying, can I trust this guy too? But when it comes to the allegations, it's suddenly there's a fake yearbook. I mean, he's able to create all this doubt and then push against the mainstream media who's out to get me. He's literally playing right into the Trump handbook. And you got Trump and Bannon, you know, along there with him trying to create that tribal divide. These moves would be like a 3 or 4 point move. So what I mean by that is, you know, we could be behind 45-44 or we'd be ahead 45-44. And then Trump would go out in the White House and say something about, you know, Roy Moore is who we need. We got to save the seat, and then go trash Doug Jones as weak on crime when he had been a tough prosecutor, put the Klan in prison. You know, I mean, but he would go do that. He would move, but he'd move to like a 3 or 4 point lead.
Trump was helpful for more in Alabama.
For 3 or 4 points for like 3 or 4 days. And then it would drift right back to us. And so like the thing I still wonder about was when Trump went in on Friday in Pensacola. Man, thank you for not going in Sunday. Because Friday night, Moore went ahead 4 points again. Saturday, it was 3 points. Sunday, it was 2 points. We're sitting there Monday night going like, keep drifting. But Monday night, we were up by two. So it had happened just like every other time. I mean, the key to thinking about it from our point of view was, wait a minute, 4 points? That's it? Alabama, you won by 28 points here 13 months ago, and all you do is move Roy Moore from 44 to 48, and we're still at 45, or maybe we drifted down to 44. So that's it. I mean, when you say, well, so he helped him? Yeah, what he helped him do is get from 44 to 48 for 3 or 4 days, and then it would drift back down. So we're sitting there at the end watching him pop him to 48 again, never over 50, and he's drifting down. We're starting to come up, and we go by him on Monday night. Now, I got to admit, you know, Tuesday, it wasn't like, you know, having seen that move and sort of see the drift going on, you know, we were on the edge of our seats all day long. And there was a good hour and a half on election night, I think, when he went up like 75, 80,000 votes ahead of us. But we were tracking what precincts were out, and we knew almost everything. In fact, everything left but except 17 precincts in Shelby County, where we were outperforming where we thought we needed to be, even though that's a big, that was going to be Roy Moore territory. And we added it all up, and we were probably about an hour ahead of everybody else, knowing, hey, it's going to be close, could be 7,000 votes, could be 30, but it's going to be somewhere between 7 and 30,000, ended up being, I think, around 23.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
There was no one like Trump for you, though. There was no national Democrat who could come in and help out. I mean, it seemed to me that you all made a choice not to nationalize the election.
No, that's a point. The whole point was Doug Jones himself embodied the opposite of what's happening in our politics today. I mean, is his persona, not being a politician, being a guy who's going to get justice for anybody and everybody and not back down, not back away, and that we have to work together to get things done and stop the division and the hatred and the chaos that's up in Washington. And by the way, if you want more chaos, send Roy Moore. It'll be great, you know. To a place, by the way, who had sent Trump into the presidency, probably wanting the disruption and some of the chaos that he created. But there's something going on where, okay, I'm for that, but I don't want any more of it. And Roy Moore sort of represented, I think, to a lot of people that there would be an increase of divisiveness, of hatred, of chaos. And so for Doug Jones, it was, we wanted the race to be seen as Jones versus Moore, that this chaos maker and this guy who wants to reach across party lines and actually find some common ground, and you, that's your choice, Alabama, and not, we've seen what's happened earlier in the year when a race becomes nationalized. We had no real interest in doing, not just no interest, it just wasn't who Doug Jones is.
On net, and this may sound like a dumb question, but it seems to me you may have a more complicated view of it. On net, did the allegations and the focus on the allegations around Roy Moore's sexual predation, did that help or hurt Moore?
I think both. I mean, I just think it those were allegations he could cast doubt. There was a reason that you could believe him.
So the view a lot of people have that absent those allegations, Doug Jones absolutely loses. You don't agree with that view?
No, not at all. I wouldn't say we'll never know if we could have won without the allegations. I'm not saying that. But no, we had a dead heat before that, and it was all based on their understanding of who Roy Moore was, and Alabama knew who he was, and Doug Jones, the guy who took on the Klan and was wanted justice for everybody and was and wanted to find common ground. I mean, that was the choice, and we were in a dead heat in Alabama, you know, the day before the Washington Post. We ended up winning a dead heat in Alabama on Election Day. So there were some 3 or 4 point moves in there because of the allegations and because of the injection of Trump, et cetera. But in the end, the race was pretty defined by the time those allegations came out. I definitely think they hurt him. I mean, they didn't help him. But, you know, had we spent all those days talking about why he'd been removed from office, you know, some of the crazy things he'd said over time and some of his policies and things, I'm not saying we would have won that, but I think it's an oversimplification to say, oh, yeah, well, you know, anybody could have won against that guy, you know, once those allegations came out. That, first of all, the closeness of the race tells you that's not true. I mean, come on, 23,000 votes the other way, and you know, Trippy's an idiot, right? And so is everybody else who worked for Doug Jones. I mean, I've been around in this business long enough to know, like, that's how it works. And, you know, this was really something, I think, that we had gotten to a dead heat long before those charges. And I think we would have had a dogfight the rest of the way, and we may have, I don't think the result would have been a whole lot different. I think we would have won or lost by 2 points, and that's sort of where, I mean, when you look at on Election Day, Trump has a 48% favorable and a 48% negative in Alabama.
Unreal.
And that's what I'm trying to say. That had happened. That has nothing to do with the allegations. I mean, and by the way, I think that's why he could only move Roy Moore to 48 when he did jump in. So I don't know the utility that he's going to be. I mean, to other Republicans in places that aren't Alabama. I mean, it's 48-48 in Alabama. I don't know what it. I mean, you know, it's that's got to be one of the high watermarks for him. Maybe West Virginia's higher. I mean, I just think there was when you look at his favorable, when you look at where Roy Moore moved to when Trump came into the fray, would move him to 48, never a point above. I think there's limited utility there, and I think that does tell you something. There were problems way before the allegations. I'm not saying he may have beat us 51-49 without him. We'll never know that.
So I was paying attention to the polls throughout this, and I would see these polls that were like plus 13 Roy Moore and minus or plus 9 Doug Jones, and good. I mean, it was all over. And what I heard people saying over and over again was that it is almost impossible to figure out how to model turnout so that you're appropriately weighting your polls
right.
In an Alabama special election under these conditions. So how were you all polling this race? How were you all getting data that you could actually trust?
Well, Paul Maslin and Rick Sklar's were the polling team on the, you know, led by Paul. They modeled the race several different gradations of turnout. Under almost all of them, we barely would win. I mean, in other words, we would like, you know, we'd sit there and no matter what we did, it was going to be 49, 48 point something, you know, or something like that. I mean, I remember one day we were modeling an 820,000 vote turnout, and under an 820,000, we projected we could, given our number, polling numbers, we'd win 412 to 408, right? I mean, 412,000 to 408,000. That's when, if it's 820. So then we would like run the model. What happens if it's, you know, 950 and we win by like 16,000 votes. And we modeled all the way up to, I think, like 1,150,000 and we're winning by 18,000. I mean, it just, because you're getting some, you know.
But why is that? I mean, that seems like in every one of those model assumptions, you're assuming that changes in turnout are hitting both sides equally.
No, because what we're looking at is how many African Americans are telling us, what percentage of them are telling us they're going to vote in college-educated whites and, you know, all that, and what's their intensity level. So, like, what was happening during the entire campaign was, you know, you start out the campaign and on a 0 to 100 scale of intensity, 60% or 90 or above. Well, those people are voting right now. What's that model look like? And, you know, what now let's go down the scale a little. And, but by the end of the campaign, it was something like 80% of the people in our surveys were in that 90 to 100 thing. I mean, every single one of them was going to vote. So all I'm saying is there was no level that we found where, like, again, not conning ourselves about we're going to turn out more African Americans or maybe more millennials will vote than we think or that are telling us, but just sort of modeling it along the way. We always were in the lead when we projected things, but by like ridiculously small margins. I mean, I think we probably had to spend more money on digital advertising or digital than any Senate campaign in history. I mean, we were going after every under 45-year-old person on the planet, no matter, well, in Alabama, but, in, that we could find with different targets. You know, people paid a lot of attention to the TV ads and things like that, and certainly we couldn't have done it with what happened in Get Out the Vote in the African-American community, but I'm sure when it's over and we look at it, there's not going to have been a Senate campaign prior to this that spent as much money on digital than we did trying to reach people that weren't seeing our television or hearing us knocking on their doors.
Last week, Kanye West accused one of the biggest Twitch streamers of being an industry plant. It's an idea that comes up so often on platforms like TikTok and elsewhere.
You see people who have blown up seemingly overnight, and the question is, who's behind them, right? That's what everyone wants to know. Tipping the scales and pulling the lever to make them seemingly the next it thing on the internet.
This week on Power User, is it even possible to create an industry plant on the internet? And if so, how?
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden. But this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there is no way that Israel should be able to participate in Eurovision.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
One of the things that I found interesting about the campaign was a model that I've become used to for Democrats running in very conservative southern states is for them to run on pretty conservative platforms, to run as a pro-life Democrat, to run as, you know, a sort of what in another context you might call like a Democrat in name only. And Doug Jones didn't do that. He was very pro-choice in the campaign. He was against the Republican tax bill. I mean, he was, I don't think, particularly loud about his progressivism, but on the other hand, it wasn't a very moderated form of it either. And I'm curious,
No, and they made they made sure that on digital and in advertising to go after us on all that stuff.
Was that a choice?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, the one thing even at that dinner was, you know, he didn't want to run if it was a suicide mission, and he didn't want to run by changing positions or somehow pandering to part of the electorate that meant he had to change, you know, where he really stood on things. This is a guy who was not, you could not walk into the room and say, hey, the poll says, you know, 68% of the people of Alabama are for X, and you're on the other side of that. He's the kind of person that would go out and say, we don't agree, let me explain to you why I'm where I'm at and why we should try to find a way for us to get to some middle ground on this. Doug Jones was a realist. If that's why he got rejected, he could live with that. I mean, you know, he moved the ball forward. He wanted to win, don't get me wrong. But I actually think that we got a lot of people voting for us because, you know, Donald Trump, people know where he stood. You know, I mean, they know, you could disagree with him, but you know where he is. I'm not so sure about that with Trump now, but I mean, I'm talking about what the appeal that he has with some of his folks. I think Doug Jones got a lot of support because people just saw him. They believed him. Even if they didn't agree with him, they knew, okay, so he's not hiding that from me. So, you know, if he tells me he wants to reach common ground, then maybe he really does. I mean, I think there was an authenticity to him and a credibility to him that Moore didn't have. One of the things that kept happening when we were talking to people was they, without us bringing it up, would start talking to us about how they didn't understand why Jones, every time Jones was on television, he was always talking to them. Because every one of our spots was him just dead to camera talking to the people. We never had, you know, he's talking about being a steel worker. We never had like a steel, you know, plant behind him or anything like that, or even like going over him or pictures of his dad or in the steel mill. We didn't do that. It was always him dead to just looking and talking directly to people. And we wanted to do that. We wanted to get people to understand who and what he was and make their own judgment. But what we didn't realize was at the same time, Roy Moore never appeared in any of his ads. It was always big booming music and shots of aircraft carriers and strong for the military and all that, which is, you know, important stuff. But what was really weird was when you're on the phone, when people are on the phones and you're interacting with voters, and they're actually saying, how come Roy Moore doesn't talk to us? I trust your guy. And, you know, it's dawning on me. Roy Moore's never talked to us. If you go back at the look at the last spot we did, the last lines in it are, you know, think about it. When was the last time Roy Moore ever looked you in the eye and told you the truth? And then just then, not at the top of the spot, the negative spot, but at the very end, looking dead at you, I'm Doug Jones, and I approve this message. Just looking straight into the camera. So what we were reinforcing that this guy wasn't telling you the truth. He never looked you in the eye and told you the truth. And the entire campaign, there's one guy that's been doing that. And by the way, he's about to do it again. He's going to take responsibility for this, you know, negative ad. No one ad did any, but I'm saying that there was a method to what we were trying to do.
So if Senator Chris Van Hollen, who's running the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee for 2018, came to you and said, what are the lessons of this race for everyone else? Is the answer that, well, it's a weird Alabama race and Roy Moore is weird and there's not something universalizable here? Or do you think that there is something that the broader Democratic Party has to learn?
I think there is a almost infinite hunger in the country right now among many, many voters, Republican, Democrat, Independent, for ending the division, the hatred, the hate talk, and finding common ground. The question we had in the campaign was, well, wait a minute, there are a bunch of partisans on both sides who you say, let's find common ground, work with the other side. And they're like, what, get out of here. You know, I want somebody who's going to go punch Trump in the face and, you know, have it out with those damn Republicans on the floor and vice versa.
That was the Howard Dean campaign.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've been there. But it's a different time too. This isn't George Bush. I mean, it's a different time, and I think, I think what's going on is Trump, even with his own supporters who like him, he's created enough hostility and chaos that they don't want more of it. They can tolerate it with him, but they don't want more. They really want people to work together. And so Roy Moore represented more of that. I think both parties, candidates who are out there running right now, do not underestimate the power of pushing not just against Washington, but against, and not just against they can't get anything done, but against the division and chaotic and hostile Washington, D.C., and that it's time. It's time to actually sit down, reach across the aisle, and start getting things done for the American people. Now, the problem with that, and that's where we didn't have a primary. I mean, now let's go back to Robert Kennedy Jr.
Scion of the famous Kennedy family.
Yeah, yeah, right. So we did. I mean, we had a primary, but you know what I'm saying?
Yes,
it wasn't a fight. We didn't have to fend off a bunch of people who might have been out there. I don't know if they would or not, but it would have been, you know, wait a minute, what are you doing? You know, talking about finding common grounds with those Republicans or vice versa. That happened. I mean, we ran the honor ad, Gettysburg in the Civil War and the Battle of Little Round Top. That's probably the spot that closed it.
Can we talk about that ad for a minute?
Sure.
I think that ad is an unusual ad to somebody who is not familiar with it. So you have an ad that is about Gettysburg in Alabama.
Yeah.
And the point of that ad is that Doug Jones would like to go work with some Northerners on legislation.
Right. Yeah.
I'd like to know about the thinking of that ad.
As an Alabamian.
As an Alabamian.
He's the Alabamian in that thing, right? He wants to go meet with the representatives from Maine and the other, all the other states, not on a battlefield, but to find common ground, because there's honor and compromise and civility and getting things and coming together to get things done.
How did that ad, what is the genesis of that ad? Who had the idea of, like, let's remind Alabamian voters of the Civil War, and then
that was actually a Democrat
compromising with Maine.
That ad was really I'd give Paul Maslin credit for being the father of it. He wrote an email to me. Again, we were trying to internalize what Doug Jones had been saying to us about why he was running. You know, so we're writing, you know, things back and forth. And he wrote, Paul wrote this, like, you know, I don't know, 4 or 5 paragraph. You know, it's like this battle in Gettysburg and, you know, and reaching for common ground. And so he and I started working on it. And then Giles Perkins, I think, came up with sort of he was the chair of the campaign and not a media guy, came up with the note with the, I think, sort of the real home run line that Doug had talked to him about earlier in the thing, which was there's honor and compromise and civility. And somehow that it all came together, and we decided to, you know, that, you know, Doug didn't blink. It was why he was running. I mean, this is a guy, he saw what was happening, you know, that we're sort of coming apart as a country right now politically, that our politics are falling apart, and that the chaos of and hostility that we're seeing, you know, where people don't want to work together, they want to have a big battle in Washington, was sort of a metaphor for, you know, going to speak for Alabama, meet the representatives of the other states, not on a battlefield, but to find common ground. Washington shouldn't be a battlefield.
So then to go back to the broader question for Democrats in 2018, as you're saying, there is this issue where a Democrat running in a contested primary is going to be running against Democrats who have a very confrontational approach to Trump. And then there are going to be those who want to run a campaign that is more about turning the temperature down.
Well, that's what I'm saying is, I think the big question marks in our heads as we're going down this road of this common ground thing, using the Civil War as a way to talk about it, is what do rank and file Democrats do when they see that? I mean, what do African Americans, do we depress? Do we somehow de-energize those people who want to, you know, who really are appalled by what's going on with Trump and want to do something about it, you know, and want a Democrat to fight with him, or, you know, or to fight for the things that are in jeopardy right now. What happened was we didn't get, it was, again, we're monitoring everything and we're seeing on the 0 to 100 scale intensity levels and things. And it never, what happened was Republican women started to move to us. Younger Republicans started to move to us, and the intensity among Democrats didn't diminish. In fact, over time, kept building and building. So what I'm saying is, I think in Alabama, we pulled that off. I mean, pulled off what Doug Jones wanted to pull. I mean, from day one at that dinner, what he wanted to do. And I think there's power in it. I think it's one of these crazy things where Trump's creating all of it, right? He's creating that energy among the base that wants to come out and wants to stop and, you know, wants to make the change and wants to do something to fight back against what's happening. At the same time, he's creating enough chaos and divisiveness that Republicans who would never ordinarily vote for a Democrat, I'll vote for somebody who wants to try to find common ground and get things done for me, even if they're a Democrat. And trust me, a lot of people in Alabama had to do that, right? That's I think, a winning message. And a lot of these swing, districts. I mean, you know, there aren't that many swing districts that are plus 28 Trump out there, right?
Right.
You know,
so one thing I think that this goes to, because this is something I've been thinking about a bit recently. My intuition is that for Democrats, the winning message in 2020 is basically, it doesn't have to feel like this.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody in the country, even most Republicans, I shouldn't say anybody, right? Some people are perfectly happy here. But I think most people do not want politics to feel like this. They don't want to take up this much space in their heads. They don't want it to feel as conflictual with their neighbors. It's just like the whole thing feels terrible.
Right.
Like even no matter it feels terrible.
That's what I'm saying.
But I don't know that it doesn't have to feel like this has any chance of winning a Democratic primary at all.
No, that's exactly what we're saying. We didn't have that part. We didn't have that problem because we didn't have a primary. So the problem you've got is that in both parties, the people who want to feel this way or whatever. I don't think anybody wants to feel this way. I'm with you on that. But there, you know, where a lot of the energy is in the primaries, it has systematically started to remove the people like Doug Jones and his message on both sides. I mean, you know, we've gotten rid of almost all the blue dogs in the South in the Democratic Party, and they're getting rid of all their rhinos. And what's happening, I think, is we're creating a bigger group in Washington on both sides of that are making us feel this way, along with the president, who's the band leader. But so I think you're right. I think one of the things that worked for us, and that's actually, you just put your finger on why I think we won. They don't want to feel this way. And Roy Moore, they knew, was going to continue to make them feel this way. And they knew Doug Jones was not.
You said something to Ron Brownstein in a CNN article I've been thinking a little bit about, where you said that the angst that people would hear from activists about some of the messages was not reflected in the public. And when I asked my audience for questions for this interview, the most popular one was, why did Doug Jones say it's time to move on from Donald Trump's sexual harassment? Right? People, liberals are angry about that.
Yeah. But I mean, I think, first of all, I think he'd be the first to admit he could have said that better. But I think what he was saying was, Donald Trump's not going to resign over these charges. He's just not. It's, you know, that's not going to happen, right? You know, I'm not trying to get into, but that, I mean, that was what he was trying to say. The reality is there's a bunch of investigations going on. you know, he was thinking in terms of defending the Mueller investigation, things like that. I'm not getting into it. I had a brief conversation with him, and I know that the thing, I mean, you go back and look at what he's said about sexual harassment and Roy Moore. It was a clumsy way and didn't, you know, I think he would have said it differently, but what he meant to say, or what he is saying, is, you know, Donald Trump's not going to resign over this. He's not going to take these charges seriously. Let's get on to the things.
But the question I want to ask you about that, and it's broader here than even Doug Jones. I say this as someone who's written and said that I think Donald Trump should resign morally, that I think he should be impeached for being a dangerous president. But that said, there's going to be a lot of pressure on elected Democrats to voice the most aggressive form of the critique of Donald Trump.
Sure.
That may not be the version of Democrats that will appeal to the widest swath of the general audience. And I think the way people imagine that trade-off is that is a trade-off between base turnout and persuadable voters, right? That if you go with the, you know, Donald Trump should resign, he should be impeached, on the one hand, you get a lot of Democrats to turn out, or a lot of liberals to turn out. But if you go with a sort of broader, you know, Doug Jones in Alabama approach, then maybe you can get more of the, say, Republican college-educated women. Do you think that is a trade-off? Do you think that's a real choice or a false one?
I think it's a false one. It would be good if both parties could grow up a little. And I don't mean that, but what I mean by that is that, Roy Moore could be the senator from Alabama. That would be great, right? So, like, you know, Doug Jones is representing Alabama, not us. And I think he's going to do a damn good job of that. He's got values and he's got his principles. And all of us out there, looking at these districts, if we constantly as progressives try to nominate at all times in every case the most progressive, pure anti-Trump candidate we can find, hey, no one can challenge me on that, okay? I did Howard Dean, right? So I'm just saying, like, I think, like, yeah, we could do that. It might even make us feel really good until Election Day comes around, when in West Virginia, that doesn't work too well. And we get 8 Roy Moores instead of really good, solid Democrats who care about the right things, justice for everybody, healthcare, we're not going to love every single one of their votes. But if every time we don't love their vote, we decide we're going to, that's the end of them. Getting to where the Republicans are right now, where if you do anything that you don't agree with Trump, you're a rhino, or you're a traitor, whatever. I mean, yeah, I guess if that's where both parties end up, it's not going to be a very good place.
Are there top Democrats out there who you are looking at, or you say that's the right message nationally for the party, or that's somebody that you're just watching as a figure who you think has put their finger on something?
I'd say I don't think so. I mean, I don't mean that the wrong way. I just think that there's a lot of grappling right now, a lot of, you know, trying to figure that out. I think there are a lot of good candidates, out there, or potential candidates out there who are onto something, you know, onto this or onto that. But I don't think anybody's put a core message together that Democrats have responded to. I think my experience is that doesn't tend to happen until a presidential year. I mean, we all go out now in 2018, you have zillions of candidates running everywhere, and you know, the fight happens between wings of the party and things, and then a Howard Dean or somebody comes along that no one really saw coming, and they put, you know, they
a Donald
they,
Trump
exactly. And I think when you're out of power like this, that's what happens. Now I think there's a generational divide in the Democratic Party that I think is going to get played out in 2020. There's definitely an ideological divide that's in the party that's going to take place in 2020. And I think whoever wins the nomination will end up being the embodiment of the right, you know, what that message is that brings it all together.
One of the things that was striking to me looking over the exit poll data and the vote data in Alabama was So in 2012, young Alabamian voters went for Mitt Romney by 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
In the Jones election, they overwhelmingly went for Doug Jones. Even Romney by 4 is a pretty near vote for a Republican in Alabama. What do you think Alabama politics are like in 15 or 20 years as these generations change over?
Oh, it's, yeah, that's what's going on. I mean, as the 45 and under generation continues to move in, it's, you know, it's the new South rising. You saw that coalition coming together for Doug Jones, and it was African-Americans, women, and people under 45. And you want to, like, how breathtaking that move is? Think about this. And I think these numbers are right. Barack Obama nationwide won under 45s, I think, by 14 points, 15 points. Hillary Clinton won them by 14. Okay. In Alabama, Doug Jones won them by like 28 points. And that's, I think, happening across the country right now. I think Northam had similar numbers in Virginia. So I think, yeah, that's a real problem for Republicans over the, you know, over the long term, generationally, there's going to be. And I also think it could be, it could materialize in our 2020 presidential election, in which right now we're tending to look at a bunch of the 70-something candidates. And I think there, you know, there may be a rising tide of sort of a, I don't know, JFK, but I mean like that generational fight that happened back in that election in the 60s, you know, where we ended up going to the, you know, the youngest president in history at that point, maybe still. But I think that we could end up nominating somebody from that generation in 2020 that we're not thinking about right now.
I want to change lanes here for a couple minutes while I still have you. So you were there really at the dawn of internet age politics. I mean, I think of the Howard Dean campaign as much as any campaign of really kicking off how campaigns are done online. And it was like before really social media, right? It was Meetup.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember Meetup. And now you see Trump in his Twitter feed and Facebook and its echo chambers and its Russian bots. As somebody who is a pretty early theorist and practitioner on how the internet can change politics, are you disappointed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big time. I mean, I was probably too naive and too utopian about it and didn't see the dystopia that would result from it. But, I mean, I was about, you know, that the 2004 campaign was, you know, how do we use this stuff to empower people? And I thought it was going to be so empowering. We're going to wipe out big money in politics because all of us little people would be able to pull our money and change everything. And, you know, and that was my hope for it. Now I look at it and like, you know, I mean, the day, you know, we were tracking bots and we, like the last week, we were like 10,000 bots were generating 65,000 tweets an hour against us. Everything from pushing hashtag fake yearbook against the accuser. I mean, you know, and you're sitting there looking at this and like you're getting your bot tracking report back that 65,000 tweets an hour are hammering you. And like, you know, we're not going to go hire a Russian bot army or wherever, whoever and however that's happening.
Do you think a bot army like that matters? Like, are people paying attention? There's so much media and attention and like discussion and information in the race. Like a Turkish bot farm, is that something that when we hear it, people get scared out of proportion to its actual effect?
I think,
that like the race was pretty stable the whole time, as you say.
I think both of those things are true. We probably get freaked out by it maybe more than we should. On the other hand, in a race where I'd take this back to the presidential 2016 race too. Do I know for sure that there aren't 15,000 people in Alabama that didn't vote for Maury Moore because they believed the fake yearbook story? I mean, because they were getting it in their, you know, everything that they were seeing in their stream at that level, you know, impacted them. Is the same thing about, you know, were there 11,000 people in Michigan or you know who stayed home or didn't vote for Hillary Clinton because because of fake stories that were moving around? I'm not making the accusation that they were did, but I'm saying like that's when you get that kind of doubt going in our system. I mean, it, you know, whether we can trust what's really happening and what is or isn't fake news, and there's bot, you know, these bot armies out there. And by the way, I mean, the bot starts at a, as a bot, but then a Jones volunteer sees a bot attack more, you know, in a tweet and retweets it. And it's now coming from Joe Trippi to Ezra, right? And now, and it's now got some credibility yep. that it didn't have 5 minutes ago. And so that's the part, I think what's really, what we as Americans, as citizens, as members of our different parties need to understand is that we are unwitting part of the attack. We can, somebody can just push a little poison to me and man, it's anti-Trump. Wow. And this is really a good meme. Bam. Right. I'm retweeting it. And the other side's doing the same thing. In fact, man, this is great. We can do this. We can do this both ways, and these idiots will all beat up each other and stop talking to each other and stop getting anything done. And guess what? They'll all want to go to, they'll all want to take each other on and say horrible things about the other side. Well, guess what? It's working really well.
Do you see any reason for hope that some of the early ambitions of digital politics can be affirmed, realized? Is there some way to make what the utopians hoped a little bit more true?
I have severe doubts about it. I'm still hopeful. I do think it will probably be it could easily be the next presidential candidate that makes that happen. I'm a believer that, you know, that we tend as a people to pick opposites as our next president. And, you know, Trump, absolutely the opposite of Obama, you know, Nixon, Carter. And I think, you know, the right leader who steps forward and starts to call on the country to unity, if thousands of millions of Americans start to build into that candidate's network, that it's possible that you need something like that to sort of start to make us, you know, the one thing right now, everybody goes to their corner and they all go to their corner on social media too, you know, and that's, I don't know what the answer is. I think it's going to take somebody, a national leader stepping forward that's trusted by enough people on both sides to say, hey, let's put the weapons down. I'm not going to use my Twitter handle the way I've been using it. And we instead right now we've got a president who shows us exactly you're supposed to use Twitter. And unfortunately, I can't even counsel people not to, right? I mean, that's like, you know.
So then here's a final question we ask on this podcast, which is the opposite of how we use Twitter, which is, what are three books you've loved, cared about, influenced you, that you'd recommend people read?
Oh, man. What It Takes.
Richard
Ben
Cramer.
If you're interested in politics.
That book is how we know each other.
Yeah.
Because it got me into Gary Hart, and you were reading me because I was some random young kid into Gary Hart.
Yeah, right. And that's how I've always been. I see somebody who's starting out and say, hey, look, don't look at it this way. You know, it's not that bad. But that book, the book on Da Vinci right now, Walter Isaacson's book is great. The book on Grant.
Oh, the new biography of Ulysses Grant.
Yeah. That's a really good one too.
Cherno, right?
Yeah. Cherno. Yeah.
Joe Trippi, thank you so much.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you to Joe. That was fantastic. I have a lot here that I want to think about after this episode. Thank you to all of you for tuning in, to my producer, Jillian Weinberger. The Ezra Klein Show will be back next week.